Sarah Chase was in Afghanistan in 2001, covering the fall of the Taliban for America's National Public Radio, NPR, when she dropped her journalism career to, as she put it, stay behind in Afghanistan and try to do something. For 2.5 years, she worked for President Hamid Karzai's brother, a Baltimore businessman called Kayum, launching an NGO, and discovered that, in fact, she had enabled the development of corruption. She had, in effect, been captured by proxies with intentions that were less good than her own. A classic error of outsiders in Afghanistan, she says. She then devoted her energies to encouraging US officials to listen to the Afghan people without intermediaries. And she has written a book about not only Afghanistan, but also Egypt, Nigeria, countries where the collapse of public integrity and the rise of corruption have been addressed by a rigid, violent, extremist moral code. Sarah Che's book is called Thieves of State: Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. And I asked her how she got involved with the Karzais.
They were very good at capturing foreign journalists, and so there was a whole routine during those weeks after 9/11, of course, and before the border to Afghanistan was actually open. And a number of journalists were sort of congregated on the border, so south of the border in Pakistan. And we would often, almost every day, go and talk to Ahmed Wali Karzai, President Karzai's younger half-brother. And I also found an uncle who was living in a different house, sort of surrounded by other elders of the family and tribe. And I found them to be quite interesting to speak to, mostly about this sort of cultural environment within which events were taking place. And so because I was one of the very few who spent any time with Uncle Aziz, that's sort of how our friendship struck up.
I can see how the Karzais were very attractive. I've spoken to other journalists in Afghanistan at that time, and they all thought that, you know, President Karzai was the best thing since sliced bread and really deserved to go. What was it that first alerted you to the fact that they were, as you put it, I think, a vertically integrated crime system?
Well, the notion that the Afghan government was a vertically integrated criminal organization sort of masquerading as a government really didn't come clear to me until about 2009. But I caught on to the Karzai's own corrupt behavior quite a bit earlier than that, not as early as I should have. But certainly by 2002, I was beginning to have some doubts, in particular based on their attitude toward what you could consider development assistance. And it became really clear to me as early as 2002 that they were interested in capturing development assistance, either by falsifying salary records or by getting development organizations to help pay for what was clearly going to be a for-profit housing development that they got involved in. So there's a little bit of a difference between individual corrupt behavior and the crystallization of what you could really call a corrupt system. And it wasn't until much, much later that I understood those systemic attributes, which is a lot of what I discuss in Thieves of State.
There's a very poignant piece in the Boston Globe that I was reading, dated 2002, and it's, with all due respect, it's before you lost your rose-tinted spectacles, and it talks about, you know, how Kayum Karzai had impressed you as being sharp and honest and desiring what was best for his people. And Hamid Karzai, whom you were yet to meet, you said, "I feel like I know him. I suspect that he's a lot like my dad. Brilliant, down-to-earth, funny, dyed-in-the-wool political animal, deeply good person, instinctively believes good of everyone around him." And there you were working for Afghans for Civil Society. You had really drunk the Kool-Aid at that point, right?
I think everyone had drunk the Kool-Aid, if it was Kool-Aid. I think everyone, I don't know of a single person who didn't see, including Afghans, incidentally. I mean, the mandate that President Karzai had initially was just overwhelming. And that's one of the tragedies of his presidency, is that he really had the popular mandate necessary to put together a really constructive government, and yet that's not at all the course that he took. I mean, I think outsiders also were seeing this as an opportunity to really transform a kind of relationship between a Western power and a very emblematic element of the Islamic world.
Was there a particular incident that prompted you to break with the Karzais completely?
I don't think there was a specific incident. It really was a series of sort of pieces of evidence that became more and more difficult to ignore. It's quite interesting, again, as a Westerner in an environment like that, there is a tendency to believe what you hear. And it is true that Kayyum Karzai is one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. And he had fantastically good arguments and even insights about how his country worked. What was very difficult was really metabolizing how completely opposed what he was doing was from what he was saying, that he was actually participating in the very type of dysfunction or malfeasance that he was to some extent describing. But I would say really coming to understand how they had functioned during the period of the Soviet occupation. I think also a plan of Kayyum's to basically use our nonprofit organization, our charity, as an interface between private militias that he wanted to set up in the countryside and the Afghan Ministry of the Interior, which really was not an appropriate role for a nonprofit, and also to essentially get involved in both lobbying and kind of intelligence work on the ground in Afghanistan, a plan that he cooked up without really discussing it with me, who was supposed to be his field director. Those were some of the things that added up to an environment that I really did not want to work in.
What you did then is interesting. You set up a soap factory. You got some money from Oprah Winfrey, and you established a soap factory, which you called the Argand Collective in Kandahar. Interesting project. There's a story that you cite in the book that Nurala tells you that is kind of the penny dropping for you in many ways. What was the story he told you about his brother?
This is a story that gets at the heart of one element of corruption in a country like Afghanistan or some of the others that I've subsequently looked at that is quite unfamiliar to most Westerners. I mean, of course, corruption exists everywhere. It exists in New Zealand. It exists here in Washington, D.C., from where I'm speaking to you, you know. But one aspect that we tend to miss in more developed or more Western countries is the personally humiliating aspect of how money is extorted from ordinary people in pervasively corrupt countries like this. So Nurala told us the story of his brother, who had made the hour-and-a-half drive into Kandahar from the Pakistani border and had been shaken down, I don't know, four or five times by quite contemptuous police officers on the way. And when he reached Kandahar, another police officer asked him for more money, and he says, no, you know, I've paid four or five times. I even paid my customs dues, which most people don't, and I'm through with you people. And that police officer at Kandahar hit him. So, you know, we're in a context here of proud young Afghan men who have their dignity robbed as well as their money. Nurala, a very fiery, very intelligent young man, is absolutely furious and basically says, look, next time I see somebody planting an improvised bomb in the road and I see a police car coming along, I'm not going to warn him. Now, that may have been rhetoric, but for him to say that to an American, it's pretty significant, and it really helps to show how this type of corruption perpetrated in this way can drive people into the arms of extremist movements.
How did you move from running a soap factory to giving advice to General Stanley McChrystal?
The soap factory, part of the point of that was Afghans, like just about anyone anywhere, were interested in employment. And after a while, they said, why don't you foreigners make, expand employment opportunities for us? And so it really seemed to me incumbent on me. And that region, as dry and arid and unforgiving as it looks, produces some of the finest fruit in the world. And so the issue for me was, how could you transform fruit products into something that's less heavy and less perishable? And that's where we got to skincare products. But running a small factory staffed by men and women from 9 different tribes and ethnic groups and villages all around the former Taliban stronghold of Kandahar, as well as the city itself, turns out to be a remarkable place from which to observe the expanding war. So by about 6 or 7 years into this, I actually know quite a bit more about how the Taliban are functioning and also what is driving people into their arms than most people do. There just weren't a lot of Americans in southern Afghanistan who could speak Pashto and had that kind of a sort of perspective.
I mean, you were truly embedded,
unfolding,
right?
Events.
You were embedded.
Sorry?
You were embedded with the Afghan people.
That's right. Oh. Yeah, that's exactly right. And, no barbed wire, no sandbags. I really was part of this community.
Just the Kalashnikov.
Yes, we did have Kalashnikovs, but just about everybody has those, in southern Afghanistan. Just about everybody has a gun. And I didn't feel like I could deprive my guys of the opportunity of at least taking one or two of them with us if we were going to go. That was kind of the thinking behind it. But I began, first of all, by taking part in training exercises for incoming headquarters elements, because, again, as someone who was able to sort of speak for the Afghan population as well as a Westerner could, and had some insights into how they saw the Western intervention and what cultural elements were important, and frankly, also quite a few tactical military elements. For example, Western military officers thought that the Taliban were entirely opportunistic in their attacks, and that it was really a matter of, well, if we squeeze the plastic bag here, they'll pop out someplace else. Whereas I could see over the course of this 5, 6, 7, 8 years that there was clearly a campaign plan. They clearly had a strategic objective and were responding very rationally to how the international forces were deploying themselves. So this type of information I would be briefing and working with incoming headquarters elements. And so from there, you begin to have relationships among the international military and indeed civilian advisors, and was eventually, in I think late 2008, invited up to Kabul to brief the overall command of the international forces in Kabul. And after 2 or 3 sessions like that over the course of maybe 3 months, the commander of the international forces asked me to join his staff as an advisor.
There are a number of points you make in the book. One of them is that infusions of development resources often exacerbated the local conflict, which is kind of depressing. How did that happen?
If you think of the government or even local power structures in a situation like this as arraying themselves so as to capture revenue streams, then you will see that development assistance becomes one of the most important revenue streams. And when it is delivered without opportunities for serious oversight and quality monitoring and things like that, it will simply be captured. And if you think of a government, even at the local level, of being a structured criminal organization whose objective is to maximize gain for its members, then of course they're going to jump on development assistance. And unless that assistance is delivered in a very thoughtful way with significant input from all members of the community who are supposed to benefit from it, it will rapidly be captured and therefore become a source of conflict among competing power brokers.
I'm talking to Sarah Chase about her book, Thieves of State, Why Corruption Threatens Global Security. I understand your link between corruption and extreme moral groups such as Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram, but how does a country get this corrupt? Because you've said that in the 60s and 70s, Afghanistan was pretty much a working and operating society, not a failed society at that point.
First, you had, in the case of Afghanistan, you had almost a complete destruction of its institutions, its social and intellectual elites by the Soviet invasion. Then the Soviets withdraw, and what had happened in Afghanistan, and this I think is also the case in a number of other countries that could be called failing states, is you have essentially local power brokers who start competing for access to revenues, right? And so then you have a kind of civil war type situation, which is what existed in Afghanistan in the early 1990s, and you could argue exists today in Somalia, or indeed in Libya, or potentially some even Latin American countries. What then happened is that the people turned to the Taliban as a more structured alternative to that type of violent chaos. And so Afghans didn't turn to the Taliban out of a desire for the religious ideology, but rather for the desire for a government. Then the West comes in, the United States comes in and topples the Taliban and essentially brings these warlords back into Afghanistan who had been either killed or some of them had been chased out by the Taliban. And so the United States essentially brought these criminals back into Afghanistan and then brought them into governing positions and then treated them like a government and never counteracted the incentive structure that helped these individuals crystallize themselves into a network. In other countries, let's take Nigeria, where I've been spending quite a bit of time in the last year, that's a place where you had a pretty extractive colonial system, which unfortunately got taken over almost whole cloth by the elites of the newly independent country. And then a situation there and in other such countries that fit this description, where there's been a disintegration of what had been, I think, in the 60s and 70s and even much of the 80s, at least a degree of social contract and a degree of a sense that there had to be a downward distribution of public goods. By the 1990s, that breaks down. It breaks down partly because of a so-called resource curse, countries that have natural resources that then get captured by their governing elites. And also, I think it breaks down partly because of a generalized change in public ethics that has been sweeping the world, largely again driven by the US and the UK, the sort of Reagan-Thatcher greed is good ethos, globalization, collapse of the communist both system and therefore discrediting of the communist ideology, which said, look, there has to be at least a minimum level of public goods that are provided to a population, and there's a cap on the amount of personal wealth that can be amassed and displayed and enjoyed by elites. All of that changed in the 1990s, and you get sort of greed is good, and you get the elites in countries like Nigeria or like Egypt or like Tunisia, just or Ukraine. You know, look at the Yanukovych palace, where these elites are now just amassing storehouses of wealth, and they're also able to place it offshore in bank accounts in the West, and they're able to buy property in the West and send their kids to school in the West and things like that. So there's been a real change in public morality, which is infecting the West as well as developing countries, and I think has something to do with the financial crisis of 2008.
So there's a lot of answers in that answer, but
at the
end of the Cold War, you're saying the reasonable socialist baby was thrown out with the communist water.
I think that's a fair way of putting it. That's right.
It's something of a cliche. All right, so you talk to these military... Sorry?
I'd just like to... You say you understand the connection to violent puritanical religion. But I think not everyone does. And the way that link happens is like this. Let's go back to the story of Nurullah, who's absolutely furious that his brother has been smacked by a police officer. Nurullah, after this happens two or three times, or indeed his brother, they want to get some revenge. After this happens a couple of times, they want to kill that police officer. Well, in a place like Kandahar, they have the opportunity because right all around them are Taliban who are actually begging them, come join us, come and you can kill that police officer. So the extremist movement gives them an opportunity to take their revenge, but it also gives them an argument, which is the reason that police officer is behaving in such a depraved and corrupt way is because he's not obeying God's law. And if only our government were structured according to God's law, then this police officer or this judge or this county clerk could not behave in such a corrupt fashion. Now, that argument has real limitations when you look at Iran, where people, came into power, the current government came into power on that argument and has proven to be quite as corrupt as the Shah's government was. But when you're an angry young man in southern Afghanistan or northern Nigeria, you're not, doing comparative political analysis, right? This is an argument that has a lot of resonance. And I think it's important for Westerners and non-Muslims to remember that a lot of our own political history is shot through with a similar argument, where people have said that the only way to achieve public integrity is by way of private morality, sometimes strictly enforced. And what I argue in Thieves of State is that the Protestant Reformation can actually be seen in a quite similar light as a violent extremist reaction to acute corruption in the public sphere, in the sort of relationship between the Catholic Church and divine right monarchies during that 16th century period.
Yeah, well, I mean, that puts Martin Luther in a whole new light, but
read the 95 Theses.
Not quite in the same league as the Taliban, surely.
No, but that was not a peaceful movement, the early Protestant movement. It was pretty violent, and a lot of blood was shed in religious wars. And if you read Martin Luther, wow, he's a piece of work. He's a piece of work, and he has a lot to say, and quite acerbically, about the corruption of the Catholic Church.
Was anybody receptive then, in a constructive fashion, to the idea that it was corruption that discredited the Afghan government and made the Taliban attractive?
There were a number of, I would say, rule of law professionals who really were on top of this. In particular, there was UK prosecutors or police investigators who were creating special anti-corruption teams within the Afghan police and the Afghan Attorney General's office. There was also a threat finance cell that was put together by a U.S. At the time, he was a Drug Enforcement Administration investigator whose job initially was to look for funding streams for the Taliban. But scratching the surface of those funding streams, he was almost drowned in a tsunami of corruption money. And so he became very bent on this issue and how much impact it was having on the war. And in fact, he discovered a nearly billion-dollar hole in the Kabul Bank, which was being used as a Ponzi scheme by its board of directors. But the other really interesting person was my former boss in the military, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who very quickly, I would say by 2009 certainly, was understanding that this was absolutely a mission critical issue, that he could not with his instruments win the war, as it were, if this issue of corruption were not addressed. And he raised this issue at the very highest levels of the U.S. government. Interestingly, it was civilian leadership, including our State Department Foreign Ministry and the Department of Defense civilians, who were much less receptive to this issue than some of the uniformed military who had really been living with it on a day-to-day basis.
It's harder, isn't it? I mean, security first is a simple message. But
it
corruption, how do you deal with corruption?
And it turns out there are just lots of levers that you can use. And that's part of the work that I did for Admiral Mullen, was actually, you know, kind of fleshing out what all of the levers were that were available to different branches of the U.S. government, be it how military or civilian officers meet with their Afghan counterparts, be it how foreign assistance is delivered, be it visa denials, asset forfeitures. A number of these individuals were U.S. citizens and could easily have been prosecuted in U.S. courts, let alone whether our intelligence agencies ought to be paying millions of dollars in cash to some of these incredibly corrupt officials, including the president of Afghanistan himself. And so what you unfortunately had and have elsewhere, it's I've been looking at the U.S. in particular, but other Western governments are not a lot better, is you have a really self-contradictory policy where, you know, on the one hand, maybe very rousing lip service is paid to how bad corruption is, but then meanwhile, highly corrupt officials are placing their assets in Western banks or buying Western real estate with it. So unfortunately, I don't think it's that difficult to begin changing the incentive structure here. I think the issue is that then you'd have to take on some very significant economic and, dare I say, political interests here in the West.
As you say, the CIA was paying at least one of the most corrupt of the Karzais. How do you know that?
Well, I know that they were paying Ahmed Wali Karzai because I saw it back in 2002 when I was close to the family. I saw CIA officials in his house handing him a tinfoil wrapped package that, I mean, I didn't see inside the package, but I'm sure that it was money. And then very good reporting was done subsequently into the millions of dollars that were delivered to President Karzai over all of those years.
So the policy of the CIA and indeed other branches of the U.S. administration would be that the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Basically, and that both in return for intelligence, in return for, quote, loyalty, as a guarantee of, quote, stability, these payments needed to be made. Now, I deeply disagree with that. I think that money is not does not always buy what the spender hopes that it will buy. And very often what ended up happening was that Afghan officials took Western money, or also not Western. Iran was also paying President Karzai. I mean, lots of people were involved in this game. But often officials take the money and then instrumentalize these foreign so-called patrons to do their work for them. For example, there was one time when a friend of mine, basically ran down the Taliban commanders that U.S. forces had either captured, killed, or who had fled to Pakistan over the previous several months. And they were all Taliban commanders in the area. It's just that they were all one tribe. And then he ran down the names of the Taliban commanders who were members of President Karzai's tribe, and none of those had been bothered at all. And those are some of the drawbacks of relying on, you know, certain power brokers for your intelligence, is it ends up being those power brokers who are instrumentalizing you rather than vice versa. And I would suggest that similar things are happening perhaps in Yemen and other places where the U.S. and other foreign or Western countries are conducting counterterrorism operations.
But it goes even further than that. You say even the simple notion that the international community should not shower the most corrupt Afghans with honors was hard to implement, and you give You give the example of Daoud Daoud, who was the Afghan minister of narcotics. What was he up to?
He was the counter-narcotics minister, so not the minister of narcotics,
no.
Although he might as well have been that, because he was one of the biggest drug dealers in the Afghan north. And at one point, there was intelligence indicating that he had actually been part of basically initiating an Afghan National Army military action in order to protect one of his drug trafficking networks. And then I discovered that a U.S.-funded installation in Germany, which provides training to allied militaries and law enforcement organizations internationally, was inviting this Daoud Daoud to be the speaker on counter-narcotics in Afghanistan. That we were able to get turned off. But another example is a general now called Razik, who became police chief of Kandahar. I mean, this guy was involved in not just corrupt activities, but absolutely well-documented violations of human rights, including basically arbitrary killings. And there's been a UN report on him more recently since I left Afghanistan. But this guy was the hero of the troop surge into southern Afghanistan in 2010.
The current Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, I've just been reading assessments of him. We've got, taking a description at random, listening to his many speeches and interviews and meeting after meeting during this week's trip to, and this was written in March, trip to DC and New York. It's clear that decades of study and practice have prepared him superbly. He exudes confidence and brilliance. He references a dizzying array of facts and statistics and history and theory. He lays out a strategy for fixing Afghanistan. Now, not to speak badly of President Ashraf Ghani, but I'm getting a deja vu feeling here. What is your opinion?
The same. I've become a little bit inoculated to Afghan officials who know how to phrase their statements in terms that their audience wants to hear. I, at this point, will wait to see what President Ghani actually does.
I'm talking to the author of a book called Thieves of State, Sarah Chase. The big question, then, underlining all this, is how outsiders can improve a nation without dealing with the power brokers. Is there some kind of template that we can apply to the other countries that you've looked at? Nigeria, Uzbekistan, Egypt.
Of course there's no template, because if you look at the countries where, in my view, corruption has been an underlying driver of a really significant security event, they seem on the surface of them to be quite disparate, right? So if you look at the six or eight Arab countries that went into revolution in 2011 and the very disparate ways that those events have played out in the years since, if you look at a lot of Central Asia, if you look at the expansion of ISIS, you know, both in Syria and then back into Iraq, if you look at the spread of similar movements in West Africa, if you look at some other situations that I dwell on much less, like symbiotic alliances between acutely corrupt governments and what can only be termed transnational criminal superpowers, which exist, I would say, in the Balkans, in some Latin American countries, and in some Sahel countries in Africa. This looks like a dizzying array of very different security crises. To say, to begin with, that corruption is a thread, a single thread that runs through all of these very different situations, is already saying a lot. So just understanding that fact is already quite important, I think. Then, naturally, there's no template that you could apply to all of these different countries. But the first point that I would make is it's not either sign a blank check or not deal with the power brokers at all. I think after corruption's a factor in all of these crises, the second thing I'd like to say is it's not black or white. It's not an all or nothing response. There's an enormous range of different actions that both civil society activists inside these countries and outsiders can bring to bear on these situations. And then the third thing I'd like to say is they need to be understood specifically. And that means the very first thing that needs to happen is a rigorous structural analysis of the criminal network that's running the government, right? You need to know what elements of state function has this kleptocratic network bent to its purposes. What elements of state function has it hollowed out deliberately or pillaged, like the armies of Ukraine, Iraq, and Nigeria, for example, in recent months? What are the revenue streams that it's capturing? What are its key enablers, both within its country and abroad, like banks or law firms or something like that? What are its aspirations and vulnerabilities? So once that type of an analysis has been conducted, then you can begin to understand what are the types of actions that could most effectively change the incentive structure operating on this kleptocratic network. Now, in all of these cases, you know, there are political trade-offs. Let's say I want to advise the U.S. government to have a different approach toward the government of Bahrain, which is one of these kleptocratic networks. And that's a powder keg. Bahrain, which is this tiny little country that, like the pea in the princess's mattress, sits between Iran and Saudi Arabia, almost like a tiny little buffer. That country is incredibly strategic. It also happens to be the place where the United States harbors its Fifth Fleet. So that's a very strategically important country for the United States. The United States is unlikely to want to
mess with Bahrain.
Right, mess with the government of Bahrain. So then you need to think really precisely and creatively about what are the levers that the United States holds that could begin to change the incentive structure on that government and begin nudging it toward a more constructive approach to its own citizenry. Because in the end, its kleptocratic practices are suicidal, as, you know, the fate of Ben Ali and Mubarak demonstrates.
I mean, we were talking about Saudi Arabia on this program last week, and similarly,
right,
you know, nobody's going to mess with Saudi Arabia because the United States regards Saudi Arabia as the last bastion against the barbarians.
Well, it's pretty interesting to see. It's quite slight, but you are beginning to see some movement on the part of the United States towards perhaps a more balanced set of relationships in the Middle East. Now, it's not nearly as significant or as thoroughgoing as I think it ought to be, but there are some signs that the U.S. is, you know, beginning to see some of these issues a little bit differently. I think Nigeria is another very interesting example where 257 girls get kidnapped last spring, you know, and carried off into the forest. And there's a lot of rhetoric about how terrible this terrorist action is. And certain people within the U.S. government were in favor of, you know, a bombing campaign against Boko Haram. That didn't happen. Partly because the commander of U.S. Africa Command, the sort of regional command over that area, is one of the military officers who does understand how terribly important governance is in this whole equation. And he said, there is no way that U.S. forces are going to partner with the abusive army of the abusive and corrupt government of Nigeria. And he really held the line on that. So if you look carefully, you'll see that there was not the type of counterterrorism support provided by the U.S. military to the Nigerian military as might have been the case some time ago.
That's the trouble with corruption, isn't it? I was just thinking about, you know, we want a fix on this. We need a solution. But the nature of corruption is that it grows and grows because all you need is one bent person. And they're everywhere. When you were working in the soap factory, for example, with your friends, did you not come to distrust them also? How do you know they weren't proxies?
Well, I, at that point, spoke the language. I was running my own organization. I was keeping the books. And so I was able to keep a pretty close watch over it. And so I'm quite convinced that they were not. I just wasn't reliant on intermediaries as much as internationals usually are.
What happened to that soap factory? Is it still going?
Yes, it is. And you can order products. It's soap and it's oil, skin oils and lotions and lip balms and things like that. It's Argand, ARGHAND.org. And it's really terrific stuff because we extract all of our own raw materials from local agricultural product, be it almonds. They have wild almonds in Afghanistan, pomegranate seeds, anise seeds. It's all of the coloring is locally sourced vegetable dyes. We extracted essential oils. We distilled essential oils for the fragrances. So it really is kind of remarkable and heartwarming to be able to produce something of that kind of quality in such a forbidding environment.
I was thinking about almonds. We've been hearing in the Californian drought that almonds are major users of water and that farmers growing almonds are doing a disservice to the state because they're using more than their fair share. So where's the water in Afghanistan to grow almonds?
It's a great question. Afghanistan, southern Afghanistan, is quite parched. It is watered by an ancient underground irrigation system. So water is, it's essentially snowmelt from the mountains that is carried in underground irrigation channels down into the valleys where it then comes above ground. And unfortunately, quite a democratic social structure for sharing water out among villagers also has led to practices that are not very conservative of water because individual farms may only get water once a week. And so the tendency is to flood the fields, which means a lot of water is lost to evaporation. And I really wish that more of the development effort had been spent in sustainable agricultural methodology like drip irrigation or something close to it and solar powering for agricultural machinery.
You're obviously maintaining your links with Afghanistan. Is that your main focus or have you diversified?
It's not. No. I haven't been really seriously focused on Afghanistan since the end of 2011. Once I watched the U.S. government explicitly make the decision not to address either of the drivers of the conflict, which were corruption and governance on the one hand and the role of Pakistan on the other. And I watched those decisions being made during the course of 2011. At that point, it just didn't seem worth it to me to devote a huge amount of my effort to what I knew was going to be an inconclusive at best mission. And so what I first did was extract the lessons from that experience to these other areas that have been generating security crises, you know, almost every month since the end of 2011. And that means, as I said, the Arab Spring countries, Central Asia, West Africa. And I spent a lot of time in a number of those countries, in Tunisia, a little bit of time in Egypt, and increasingly of late, I've been focused on Nigeria.